It was a beautiful blue sky. Monday morning, August 6th, 1945, 8:15. And the shotgun type of nuclear bomb, a shotgun type, we'll talk about that in just a second, was dropped over Hiroshima. It was only partially detonated. It was a small blast radius, yet devastating. Of the 350,000 or so people that lived in Hiroshima, about 50,000 of whom were soldiers, one third of the population was killed almost immediately. Others, many more times that, would die over time. And we'll talk about what happened then after the bomb goes off. The fireworms, the grass people, the ant people, and the last train to, well, from Hiroshima to safety, or so they thought, on coast to coast. Next, this is Ian Punnett. So the Japanese had refused the terms of surrender in late July, and Truman put everything in motion that led eventually to the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima in the early part of August. We should mention the shotgun type, isn't that what it's called? The shotgun type of bomb that was dropped over Hiroshima. That's never been used again.
No, it was not really the most user-friendly design for an atomic bomb.
Well, that I know you're being facetious, but what do you mean by that?
Yeah, it was about as dangerous to the people working with it and planning to drop it as it was to the people they were going to drop it on. I
Right.
mean, there was a fair chance it could have gone off right in the plane under the right conditions.
It was unstable. And
Yeah.
right.
It was about as stable as nitroglycerin on a train on a rickety track. And the
Oops.
only thing worse than that design was the design the Germans came up with.
Well,
Forget that one.
and that's interesting because, again, part of the story of the last train from Hiroshima is that the Germans were working on a nuclear weapon, but they had abandoned that project by and large. The Japanese thought that that was literally going to be decades away. They were caught completely flat-footed, even though they had even contemplated a nuclear weapons program right about the same time we were, if not earlier. They had come to the conclusion that it couldn't be done.
Right. They didn't have the uranium. They thought it could be done, but at the rates that they were going to be coming up with uranium-235, because the uranium bomb is a simpler design. And if you put it together right, there are ways of dividing it up so that it's a bit safer. The thing about a uranium bomb is that it takes the efforts of an entire government to separate out the uranium-235 and have enough material to make a bomb. These days, a uranium bomb could be put together, and once you have the material refined, it could be put together, the material could be smuggled, get a few items from construction sites and such, and you could put a bomb together that would fit in an SUV, and it could that kind of, once you have the material, it's simple, much simpler to put the bomb together, and it's not dangerous to work with the small nuggets of the material, and you could sleep with it under your pillow without getting sick, and it could be put together by fewer people than carried out the 9/11 attacks once the material is out there and distributed.
But the
There's a vast
Japanese,
difference between plutonium and uranium. That's
right.
what the concern is today. If some country wants to make a plutonium bomb, it's very hard to put that bomb together. That takes the efforts of a whole government to put the plutonium bomb together. And the other thing is that a plutonium bomb really leaves forensic evidence right to the reactor it came from.
But the Japanese, even after the bomb is dropped and the Japanese get the word that it's happened, they don't believe it because they don't think it's this sort of bomb is possible.
Well, stepping back, they had a couple of their nuclear scientists go out and look at Hiroshima. And in fact, one of them, he ran a Geiger counter over some teeth that he found in a cross section, found that they were radioactive, and the man next to him said, "That's it." And he said, that's it. There is no defense against this kind of power. Their scientists, however, had figured out that at the maximum production rates that America could work at, that we had probably produced maybe a maximum of 3 atomic bombs. We would have tested one to see if it worked. We dropped one. We might drop another. And it was determined that we had really done the worst that we could do with the atomic bomb. And the proof of that was that right after the Hiroshima bombing, we kept doing massive firebombings at night. And to them, that was also consistent with their idea that we really did not have many atomic bombs. And when Truman said he would keep dropping atomic bombs until we had destroyed Japan, that he was playing poker.
And they really thought there's no way he's got that many. Of course, in a way, it turns out they're right. We only had one more.
But they
were wrong.
They figured out that we only had one more bomb. What they didn't know is it still would have taken another month, maybe even on the outside 2 months, for us to deliver the material for a couple of more atomic bombs. So we were continuing with the firebombings, and after the Nagasaki bomb, there was a pause because word had been put through by the foreign minister that there might be a surrender. And in fact, the emperor recorded 278 RPM record recordings of the surrender, had them hidden. There were going to be radio stations that could broadcast this. And then there was a revolution within the palace. There was, in fact, one guy who considered himself a poet, Anami, who was an absolute lunatic. I mean, when he heard that the Hiroshima bomb looked like a beautiful flower blooming, as he called it, he said, that is the way we should all die in Japan. All of Japan's population should fall like beautiful petals from a flower.
Oh,
and
God.
That's when the foreign minister realized he's in a burning building with wounded psychotic animals, and he better tread very carefully.
Right.
There were two factions, and in fact, there were people who were beginning to side. The emperor was actually looking towards surrender. Those who sided with him, a couple of them were hacked literally to pieces during this revolution. They still considered the emperor sacred, and for a while he was actually a prisoner within his own palace. They imprisoned him, but they could not kill him.
So after the bomb goes off, and surprised as the Japanese were, let's go through some of the things that were happening on the ground. And this is not to revel in the horror of it, but it's to understand the horror of it, and just how random death could be, as in the shock bubble, that the shock cocoon could get some people but not others. And some people were, some mothers survived while their child died, and some children survived even while their parents were taken away, all because of where they were standing in a room or standing behind a pillar or bending down at the time when the blast went off.
Right. There was one child about almost a mile away who bent down to pick up a coin that fell. And the woman standing next to him was turned mostly to a vapor on one side of her body right before his eyes. There was the flash, and as the flash went away, he felt as though during the flash he had been transported to another place. He said it was almost like he was in another universe for a moment, and then he came back into a changed and changing world and saw people as the light dimmed, and yet the light was still bright enough to be vaporizing people. He was able to see the people, these just columns of smoke rising above them, and
where they had
flash wave hit.
Where they had once stood.
He had been protected by this wall when he bent down to pick up this coin, and the dividing line was so thin that it was as if a sword of light had gone over the top of his head and literally disintegrated his hair and part of his scalp down to the skull, and the rest of his body was completely unharmed.
So the only part of his body that was sticking up from behind that wall gets sheared off. Just this little tiny sliver of his head is sheared off, and he survives because it doesn't go any deeper than his skull, whereas the person who is standing up next to him is turned into what, like almost like a human charcoal statue.
Right. Out to about 1.2 miles on the bridges, people, their shadows were imprinted on the roads, on the sidewalks, on walls. There were shadows of dogs walking by there on the walls, laundry lines with the clothes hanging from the lines, leaving shadows on walls that still survived. And most people think that the shadow people, that it was a quick, painless death, that they instantly disappeared. Now, that was only true for people who were outside the bank or near the atomic dome or on the bridge nearby. They vaporized instantly. But 1.2 miles away, the people were burned on one side of their body, and the roadway, their shadows, the road was burned, but where their shadow was cast onto the road wasn't burned, and you could still see their shadows. Somewhat like if you fall asleep on a beach with your wristwatch on, the sun will slowly burn the shadow of your watch into your hand.
Right.
Only this happening in less than one-third of a second.
Less than one-third of a second. And that idea, too, that some people were alive, pardon this grisly observation, but some people were alive for just long enough to realize that half of them was either missing or had turned into something else other than human flesh, and then they died.
Yes, and some of them, in fact, lived for several days afterward. There was one boy, he was protected by the plants in the garden, and so he was burned over less than 40% of his body. He had been wearing a hat. He had been wearing white clothes that reflected a lot of the radiation. The hat protected his face. And so when they got him to the hospital, they thought he would surely live, but he was close enough to get too much of a dose from the gamma rays and the microwaves. And fireworms had come through that neighborhood. These tornadoes of fire that we'll get into later. And when his mother went back, his mother found him while still alive in a hospital in the outskirts of the city. His mother went back to the home and found part of the wall still standing with the plants in the garden and her son's shadow on the wall. Yes. And where her son had been sitting, she found his marbles melted. Interestingly, it was described that the leaves on the wall, the shadows of the leaves, were just knife-edged shadows of the leaves, except for one lone leaf that was a blurry leaf against the wall. It took about a third of a second, maybe a half or a second, for a shadow to be imprinted on a wall. So what she was looking at was a leaf that she realized had been falling at the moment the bomb ignited, and a leaf that disintegrated and never reached the ground.
There are so many stories like that, and I you know, it would be too sad to go into all of them, but I will recommend the book The Last Train from Hiroshima to people just for that purpose. So just to see some of these survivor stories and then the experience of loss that they also went through simultaneously, everybody did. And it's profound, and it's heartbreaking, and it's fascinating all at the same time. The science of that, though, is what we were talking about when you were talking about the fireworms, because the fireworms, this was something that people called them, where it appeared as though there were little, well, worms of fire flying in the air. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, the names I use in the book are the names of phenomena that children often came up with for these things. And after the bomb in Hiroshima, there were these 5, 6, up to 10-story tall tornadoes of fire. To children, they looked like giant worms. And they felt as if these things were almost living creatures. There's, as one of the survivors was describing it, it seemed to her like a scene out of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, where the Martian tripod stopped at one point at a river, and they were looking around as if deciding what to do before they crossed, and then they all crossed at once, and that's what she saw these fireworms do, except that the fireworms, when they came across the water, they started pulling up water, and they became water spouts for a while. Strong enough when they hit the opposite shore to just pelt people with pebbles and rip their clothes to shreds right off their body, and then they would continue inland where other fires were burning and draw up flames and become six-story tall fireworms again.
And the fireworms were just one of the hazards. The grass people, that was another children's term for what had happened?
Yeah, the grass boys, actually, that was a term that was used by Somo Yamaguchi,
okay,
who survived within the Ground Zero Zone, and he had military training. He was a ship designer and weapons designer and partly a spy, also translating American plans that had been captured for designs of weaponry from English into Japanese. And he, from his military training, he saw the flash, and his first thought was a bomb, an incendiary bomb is flashing right before my eyes. It's maybe 10 feet away. I'm dead. And he dove immediately into a pit. He must have made that dive into a water-filled trench near a potato farm that he was walking past. He must have made that whole motion in less than one-third of a second. And yet still, he was burned on one side of his body. His white clothing protected him to some degree, but was mostly stripped from his body. His hair was burned off. His hair had also managed to protect one side of his face somewhat. His one hand was practically degloved by the explosion and the fire. People standing around him who had been, one woman who had been dressed in black clothing, work clothing, and had been standing nearby, basically disappeared. He couldn't see her again. He was close enough to almost actually be drawn into that huge shock bubble as it collapsed into a fireball and started rising. He was actually pulled out of the pit, and he said, levitated in the air for a long time, where it seemed that the bomb was deciding whether to drop him or to pull him all the way up into the sky, and it dropped him into another mud pool instead.
And he's the one who sees these grass boys, these boys who are hit by flying blades of grass.
Grass was embedded in their bodies like little darts.
Well, that brings us to the ant people, and then inevitably to the last train from Hiroshima. We're talking with Charles Pellegrino, who brings a scientist's eye to the events of August 6, 1945. And we'll get to your questions coming up, and we'll talk about some more of the things which he's uncovered for the first time in this book. Some of the ways in which he's asking for us to reconsider the story of Hiroshima next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet. Well, we should never take another nuclear explosion for granted, and we've learned a lot from Hiroshima. We're still learning from it. In the book, Last Train from Hiroshima, we'll talk about that, plus the ant people. And when we come back with Charles Pellegrino, we'll address some of these new revelations, some of these new insights that he's brought out in the book about what happened on that day and the days afterward as well. Go to the website, coasttocoastam.com, link up to Charles Pellegrino. Also, take a look at my blog for tonight. There's some fun links on there, including the argument that's being made that the United States should be reconfigured, that the state borders should be redrawn to make it be so that every state has an equal amount of people, therefore equal representation under the law. What state would you end up in? Go take a look at coasttocoastam.com and click onto my blog. We'll get to that some other night. But for next, it's Charles Pellegrino and just what was waiting at the other end of the last train from Hiroshima next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So after the bombing of Hiroshima, Charles Pellegrino writes that the population kind of turned into the ant people. That was a term used by whom, Charles?
It was used by children. It was also used by a Dr. Hychia, who I found out totally by accident. In fact, I found his diary totally by accident. I was in a bookstore in Philadelphia on vacation, went into a used bookstore and saw in the science fiction section where I was looking, spying out Hiroshima diary. Book's been out of print for decades and decades. And it was by this Dr. Hychia. And as I'm reading that, I'm coming across the story of Mr. Sasaki. And then when I, if you know the story of Sadako Sasaki and the Thousand Paper Cranes, he was their next door neighbor. There's a whole tragic story involved in that where he became one of the ant walkers. These people who would follow each other over broken bits of building and just one person following the other over rugged trails where right nearby was an intact sidewalk and a road. They were just following blindly in shock, one behind the other.
And not blind.
Right.
Not, but just following blindly in that sense that one person was going, so they're going to follow, even though there was a clear, smooth path right next to them.
Right. And in Dr. Hychia's case, it was surprising to find that he was the Sasaki's neighbor. And I'm reading in his diary how he feared that he had caused the death of Sadako's grandmother. And meanwhile, I'm hearing from Sadako's brother about the death of the grandmother and everything. And I ask him about Dr. Hychia, and he says, yes, yes. And my father brought food down to him at the hospital to help with the patients because Hychia eventually became one of the people when he healed from his wounds that he was helping all these patients. Oh, including Barefoot Gen, the kid I was talking about who was hit by the ray over the top of his head, hit by
right.
the heat ray. As I went on with this whole study and meeting survivors, if you've ever seen an episode of Lost or read The Bridge Over San Luis Rey and how these people's lives were all interconnected, by the time I got down to Nagasaki and Mr. Yamaguchi was telling me that the doctor who helped his wife to save his life after he survived the second atomic bomb, that this doctor was his old basketball buddy, Dr. Nagai, and that I had just met his grandson, and that all these people were interrelated by chance. It was just against all probability, and across different cities, and it was really like living an episode of Lost for real.
Yeah, the interconnectedness is definitely understood when you read the book, Last Train from Hiroshima. Let me back you up, though, a little bit. So you mentioned blindly following. There were people, oddly enough, and we don't really have an explanation for this, who had been cured of a need for glasses after the bomb went off at Hiroshima. And not just one, but at least two.
At least two. One of them was a doctor who, when I met him in the United States when I was in college, and he had described how half the hospital disappeared around him up to about his waist, and he stood up and the building was gone. The other doctors were gone. The patients were gone, and he couldn't see anything. The dust was starting to clear. He couldn't see anything. His glasses had been knocked off his face, and then he found his one completely intact little music box, delicate thing. I think it was porcelain without a chip off of it, and it still played. I think the song was Let Me Call You Sweetheart.
Right.
And then he found his glasses, and he the smoke was clearing by then, and he realized that, oh, I can see. And when he put his glasses on, he couldn't see anything. And then he took his glasses off and he realized, oh, I'm seeing all the points and angles on this, all the delicate work on this music box. And he told me years later that in the understatement that the Japanese people often do use, he said, but of course I would not recommend nuclear detonations for corrective eye surgery.
No. No. And the other person, same thing, but they had the same effect. Somehow the blast corrected their vision problems.
Right.
The other guy, same thing.
He walked away from a military storehouse where he was the only survivor at the military base. And he ended up walking, I think, deeper into Ground Zero toward one of the main bridges. And there he came across a horse that started following him, and the horse had been completely degloved. If you've seen the movie Terminator 2, where Arnold Schwarzenegger pulls all the skin off of his hand, his robotic hand, that's what happened to that horse.
Yeah, and the horse is completely without any skin anywhere on its body.
Right, and it was this pinkish horse that was following him and kind of haunting him for a while, and he was a Christian, and he recalled the passage from the book, the Revelation of John, where, you know, and I beheld, I was
a pale horse.
Yeah, I, you know, the vial was opened, and look, and I beheld the pale horse, and the name of he that was on it was death, and hell came with him. And he said that horse haunted him for the rest of his life.
I could only understand that. Well, they were the ant walkers and the grass boys and everybody else had to go someplace. I mean, people had to. I mean, there was no point in going toward the center of the blast. So you want to get to water. Everybody's thirsty. And some people are trying to get on that last train from Hiroshima. Talk about what that last train represented and how many people in your story were trying to get to it.
Up to about 300 people traveled from Hiroshima to Nagasaki on these last two functioning trains that they sent out of Hiroshima. And most of them were weapons workers and the guys who had been working on making kites that could do all sorts of reconnaissance. Three of them survived both bombings. And most of them were people who worked for Mitsubishi. And they traveled through the night, seeing fire bombings of other towns on either side of the train, because those continued all the way through August 9th, through a temporary moratorium after Nagasaki to allow for a surrender, which didn't come.
Right.
they were mostly Mitsubishi engineers who had a priority to be evacuated from Hiroshima to the Mitsubishi plants in Nagasaki. About 300 people made that trip, and we know of about 30 who survived the second bombing. So roughly 90% of them were killed in the second bombing.
So here they survive Hiroshima, fight their way to get onto the last train that takes them to Nagasaki. Where how long had they been in Nagasaki when the second bomb came?
Some of them were literally riding into Nagasaki as the second bomb detonated.
And so we just even heard in the news recently about one of those survivors who just died.
Right. That was Mr. Yamaguchi. And that's the amazing thing. A lot of these people became extraordinary people. They went through this whole tribulation, and they came to something like what in America we call the pay it forward principle. And Mr. Yamaguchi did all of this anonymously. He said, at first, he was very depressed and angry. He's one of the people who really helped to heal a lot of 9/11 families, including me. And he was just an amazing person. And he had gone through that. If this is his second life, having survived these two bombs, he wasn't going to go through it depressed or angry. He was going to go forth with these random acts of human tenderness, hoping that they would spread out, because the people who are wanting to do harm to the world, they're not taking a vacation at all, and that he had this kind of viral idea that by these ripples of just human kindness would go out, in addition to whatever today people like our president are trying to do to eliminate some of the nuclear weapons, hopefully stop the proliferation, hoping toward a day when there might be no atomic bombs in the world, however, you know, low that probability is. But right. That in addition to what leaders are doing, that there's something that every child can do, that every person can do. And his hope was that maybe it would reach into the life of someone who might otherwise become a terrorist and change some child in another direction. And he did this anonymously for most of his life, not wanting to be known as a Hiroshima or a Nagasaki survivor or both, because for one, there was a lot of prejudice as far as whether you could be hired for a job, whether people would let you marry a survivor, because they were almost like lepers in society, the survivors.
In and Japanese society.
Yes, because he kept his he kept an anonymous, quiet life until his son died. And then he learned that Dr. Nagai's two children had died of cancer, and that finally the horrifying statistic today is that there were hundreds and hundreds, actually thousands of people who were adults at the time of the bombings that I can speak to in interview. I know of only two children, and one of them said that, yes, every child who witnessed this and who was anywhere near the Black Rain, they all died by the age of 60, usually from leukemia. What happened with Mr. Yamaguchi, though, is after these deaths, he said he had tried to escape his destiny by remaining anonymous, and that he met his destiny on the road that he had been on trying to escape it. So then he came public with it, and came public with this whole pay it forward principle that he had been putting out there for decades.
How did he help you with 9/11, Charles?
Well, basically, I got his message, and also from Sadako's brother, basically the same message. A lot of 9/11 families were very full of anger. In fact, it's through that I ended up in Hiroshima. I was working in forensic archaeology in Ground Zero, New York. Between me and Mary, we lost four people in this family.
I'm sorry.
And in this gray moonscape in Ground Zero, New York, there were these thousands of colorful paper cranes. One of them had a ribbon that said, "From the Children of Hiroshima." And in the family room, there was one set of paper cranes, and there was a man, filmmaker, Nakamura Productions from Japan, doing a film about me working in forensic archaeology in all three, in Ground Zero, New York, and preparing to go to Japan, or I was thinking of it at the time. And I kept running into Hiroshima survivors, including this one man who lost his brother in Hiroshima. His family was impacted by Nagasaki, and he grew up to lose his son in the South Tower of the World Trade Center.
Oh, gosh.
And he and Sadako's brother were childhood friends, and they're lifelong friends, and they were the people who started the whole paper crane program. So in the family room one day, one of the things I do in the family room near Ground Zero is I try to keep objects under repair that are getting a bit too much wear and tear. And I went to this one set of paper cranes while Mr. Nakamura was filming something else on what I was doing, and four of the paper cranes fell off. And he told me that there have to be 1,000, but it turned out my children had to make four more to attach to it, because what was written on the ribbon, he translated it, said, "This bundle of paper cranes says, come back to Hiroshima. Come back soon. We are praying for you. Come back to Hiroshima." That's when I knew I had to go back there.
Yeah.
It was something I was thinking of. And, you know, it was a coincidence that just really got me in the heart. I had my children write on each of those four paper cranes that I brought back to Mr. Ito, to Sadako's brother, to Mr. Yamaguchi, and to Dr. Nagai, to his grandson. And, yeah.
That's a sweet thing to do.
I don't know if you know much about the story of Sadako and the Thousand Paper Cranes, but then her brother came back to New York, and at the Tribute Center, it's a museum and teaching center at Ground Zero that's run entirely by 9/11 families. He was welcomed there. He dedicated one of Sadako's paper cranes in the Tribute Center that you'll see there before you walk down through thousands of paper cranes into the History Center there. It's partly because of the outreach from survivors of the other two Ground Zeroes that we have this whole program today that was declared on the anniversary by the White House that, and by 9/11 family members, that we honor and remember the dead every year by this principle of service to others and hoping that it will ripple out. So it's gone full circle from Hiroshima to the United States to Ground Zero, New York. And, it actually has healed a lot of 9/11 family members.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. And I know that it's
entirely a grim message, you know, and it's that maybe, just maybe, there's at least a small chance that this change of behavior will spread out and prevent someone from doing something horrible in the future.
Well, that horrible something has often been discussed in the show, is the possibility of something small like a suitcase nuke. Can you compare the strength of Hiroshima to a modern nuclear device, even a small one?
Well, it depends where it comes from. And actually, you know, the suitcase nuke is kind of a myth. One of the things the Russians have done with their nuclear weapons and that we have done with ours, if that one is ever captured, they have to be completely rebuilt every 3 months or they won't work. Okay. And the electronics are designed to, they just won't work. Yeah. After about 3 months, and they don't quite fit in a suitcase. I mean,
all right, well, I'm
to fit it in a car,
which is good to know. But I'm partially being metaphoric on the smallest nuclear weapons, the ones that people are talking about. What is the comparison between that and Hiroshima?
The ones that would fit, that the worst is a uranium bomb that could be put together here, assembled here, or assembled out at sea and brought into port. It would be a ground-level explosion, which means in terms of radiation effects, which was one of the worst effects of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs, it would be far, far, far worse. Any downwind of one of these things detonated on the ground or in the water within the first half hour would have no chance. So you don't even send rescue teams in. They're gone.
It's just part of the picture and part of the hope of Last Train from Hiroshima. We'll get to your questions and comments coming up for Charles Pellegrino, and you can hook up to him at coasttocoastam.com. If you missed any of this interview, go back and grab it from the beginning via Streamlink and find out why Charles isn't on Amazon anymore, too. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett.